I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair had a close working relationship, especially when it came to the Iraq War. Earlier this year, Prime Minister David Cameron was not able to convince the British Parliament to support military intervention in Syria, something President Obama supported until he came out in favor of negotiations. This plus revelations about the NSA spying program got us thinking about the relationship between these two countries and how the U.S. looks to its British allies. Joining us from the NPR studio in New York is Rosa Prince, online political editor of Britain's Telegraph newspaper. And Rosa Prince, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you so much for asking me on.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Rosa, looking at this quote-unquote special relationship between the U.S. and Britain, does it still exist today with these new partners?
It's interesting, isn't it? It's something that Britain is obsessed about. Every new president, every new prime minister, that question is asked. When David Cameron came in, when President Obama was elected, there was a shift, definitely, from the old days of Bush and Blair, who, as you say, were very tight. I think the chemistry isn't great between them. I think President Obama, you know, he's the first black president. He's an outsider. In contrast, David Cameron is very much an establishment guy. He went to the elite Eton School. He's a man of privilege. I think he would very much like to have a strong relationship with President Obama. I think President Obama is not as taken with him. But there's so much that binds our two countries. There's so much that history, there's so much ongoing interest that's shared between them that the personal relationship can't really undermine all that. Right. Although I think it's certainly not as close as it was.
I wonder, too, whether the Iraq War and even Britain's support of the Iraq War has kind of soured, if not the political leaders in Britain, but it maybe even the public on this special relationship with the U.S.
Well, I think that Britain looks to America in so many areas of life. So culturally, for example, the relationship is as strong as ever. Britain is obsessed with American television, with American music.
And we like your television, too. You should know that as well.
Absolutely. No, I do know that. And I think that the two countries are very close. Yes, I think there was some war fatigue, as there is domestically here. There are a lot of Americans who don't want to be traipsing around the world, causing bloodshed, causing trouble. Yes, I think that there was some. Definitely, President Bush was not a popular president back in Britain, and Obama actually was. He was an inspirational person, as he is around the world in many ways. And now, you know, it's wait and see time for him again, as it is domestically here. We all are waiting to see what will happen in this second term, when he's really going to achieve things or not.
Well, and I have to say that for the most part, Americans really enjoy those debates in the British Parliament. They're both highly entertaining and very illuminating. And I wonder, as you look at debates in our Congress, how you would describe the kind of political speech that we have in that elected body.
It's interesting, isn't it? I know that President Obama was heckled yesterday in a public forum, and he also has come in for some hard times in Congress in a way that perhaps is unusual to an American audience. That's really something that British prime ministers have had to get used to for a while. The whole way that the House of Commons is set up is to be pretty confrontational. They have this weekly prime minister's question time where they're very rude and abusive to each other. And I guess the public takes its tone from that. So when I would travel around with the Prime Minister, for example, during election time, people were not afraid to get stuck in and say what they think. The deferential way that the President is treated here is not something that we are used to back home in Britain. In fact, I was once here at a press conference with Tony Blair and President Bush, and it's customary at the White House for the press to stand when the president comes in, as it is in anywhere he walks into. That's really not something that happens in the UK with the prime minister. It would be seen as almost engaging. It would be almost seen as being partisan if you rose. So when we all stayed seated when the two leaders walked in, President Bush was really ticked off, and he told us off. He told us to rise to our feet. It was interesting. So, yeah, seeing how President Obama has been treated in the last few days and weeks, it's almost kind of familiar to me.
Well, and I'm curious, too, about, we're using you as a kind of stand-in for your entire country. But
yeah, I'm happy to speak for the whole nation.
There you go. But I'm curious about the British perspective on the Affordable Care Act. The act has been law for a couple of while, and is for a couple of years now, but there's this very bumpy rollout of the website. You have the National Health Service, or the National Health System. How does our health care system look to you?
Right, well, I guess there's two things there. On the one hand, there's the practice of having a health service in itself. And to me, that's always seen something that's been strange about America. I mean, I guess it goes back to a very different basis for the two countries. America is such an individualist country. It's all about people standing on their own two feet. Britain is more paternal. You had, going back in time, you had these very rich people and kind of poor people, and the rich people felt an obligation to look after the poor. And I guess the National Health Service was born out of that. And it's just really not controversial there. There are controversies about how it's funded, whether it's underfunded, whether it's wasteful, but the existence is not controversial. It's very much a loved institution. Whereas I know here, the National Health Service is looked at with horror by many people, the idea that everyone has to pay to support everyone else. So when the Obamacare was being debated, it did seem to me, and I think a lot of Britons, something that was strange that there was so much heat. Now, moving on to the way it's been rolled out, I think, well, me and most people who've been following it in the UK are just as surprised and dismayed as most Americans are about the ineptitude that's happened. I mean, that's just unforgivable on any level.
And that's Rosa Prince. She's the online political editor of Britain's Telegraph newspaper, the first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We are talking about how the U.S. looks to Britain. We'll be talking about Germany, and we'll be talking about France as well. And again, if you have any questions or comments for our guests, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. One of the questions I'm going to ask all three of our guests in this hour has to do with NSA and surveillance, the data mining of phone calls, spying on friends and allies. And again, Rosa, how has this been playing out in England?
It's interesting, actually, to compare British coverage of this to other countries. I'll be very fascinated to hear from your German guests, because I get the impression that while it's generated lots of noise, there's not been much heat. So it's certainly been of interest. It's been fascinating. And there's some kind of token outrage. But really, there's not the level of downright horror and surprise that there was in other countries. I know that in Germany, this was a huge deal. Yes. Angela Merkel was personally very upset. Perhaps it goes back to those personal relationships. I think Angela Merkel, again, as an outsider, as a woman, as an East German, she had a kind of bond that she had developed with President Obama that I don't think that David Cameron had. So there wasn't, it's almost like when you fall out with your best friend, that hurts more than when you fall out with an enemy. Although it was certainly noted and talked about, there wasn't the fire. And I think also to Britain, you know, they look to an institution like the CIA. It's been the stuff of movies, it's been the stuff of books for so long. Is it really a surprise that they would be, that there would be all this going on? I think it's almost like, well, yeah, of course there would. So certainly not the sense of betrayal that there has been in the rest of Europe.
And I guess a different view of government, and in this case even government surveillance.
Right, but then Britain has its own secret service institutions which get up to all sorts of things. I mean, who knows what's been happening? Well, perhaps Edward Snowden knows, but I think that they are fairly comparable, and although fascinating, again, as I say, not a big betrayal by the states.
I'd be curious, and it's been a couple of weeks since the government's been back in business in this country, but there was a government shutdown in October. How did that play in Britain? Did that make sense to you?
No, I don't think it made sense to many Americans either. In Britain, you have a government and it stays there until it collapses, and then a new government is elected. In fact, we had a unusual situation a couple of years ago when David Cameron came to power, which was that there was no one party won the election, and he had to go into a coalition with another smaller party, and the two are working out. They keep going. The idea that you would elect a president and then bind his hands by having a Congress that is so opposed to him, again, seems very strange to me. Completely different style of government. I just couldn't understand how that could be. It seems that, I know Americans often have this concept, which is that they will elect a president from one party and then have a Congress from a different party to almost hold them back and be a check and balance. And that's great in theory. I think many Americans, perhaps, I don't want to be critical of another country too much, but perhaps the reality of that turned out not to be so good. A budget is the first thing that is passed in a British Parliament in terms of, not chronologically, but in terms of importance. If you can't get your budget through, then the whole administration will fall. There's an election and a new administration comes in. And if they are then themselves unable to pass a budget, the same thing happens. So that's the primary thing, is to get that money flowing.
We're looking at the anniversary of the Sandy Hook shooting. A young man killed, more than 20 children in a school, and a number of teachers as well. There was a big effort in this country, at least, to get some kind of gun registration that didn't get through Congress, in spite of the fact that it was supported by a majority of people, including a majority of gun owners. And again, I'm just curious about how that played in Britain.
Right. I guess this goes back to the two different systems, having a constitution here as opposed to an unwritten constitution in the UK, which means that the principle there is that no government can bind a succeeding government. So we had a awful incident, very comparable to Sandy Hook, in Dunblane, in 1996, where a number of children and their teacher were shot. And after that, very strict gun control measures were introduced. And as you say, if most Americans want that to happen here, it does seem strange, or some measure of gun control, it does seem strange that an ancient document can stop them doing that. Now, I don't want to be overcritical, because the reverse of that, the Constitution in America provides for so many wonderful things. In my own line of work, there's, of course, freedom of speech.
Sure.
And so there are many wonderful things about this system. On gun control, personally, it seemed to me a problem. I think that if the people largely want something, then that should happen, rather than it being something that is set in stone that you can't change. But I guess that's what I've grown up with.
And about 45 seconds before we have to say goodbye, so what's the biggest difference covering the British government or the American government?
The difference between the two?
Yeah.
I think it is that. It goes back to those very grassroots tacks of having a constitution, having a separation of powers. Britain is a much more fluid country. It's a little more fusty and crusty and traditional, but it doesn't have those things that hold you back, I guess.
Well, on that note, Rosa Prince, thank you so much for joining us, getting our conversation started.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's an online political editor of Britain's Telegraph newspaper. The first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. You wanted to check in and talk about the relationship between Germany and the United States. That's coming up next. And France and the United States. Any questions or comments? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The music of Vivaldi's The Four Seasons blooms in perennial splendor. The Philadelphia Orchestra and violinist Giuliano Carmignola perform The Four Seasons, Thanksgiving weekend concerts to share with family and friends. Vivaldi tickets online or at 215-893-1999. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Thanksgiving weekend at the Kimmel Center, Vivaldi's The Four Seasons with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Hi, I'm Bill Morazzo. As president of WHYY, I thank so many of you for supporting our public media services. Maybe you live in one of the nearly 100,000 households in our area that supported us this year, or you're an employee of a company that has matched those gifts. Perhaps you've donated a used car or volunteered your time. Your kindness allows us to expand our services on air and online. So as the nation gives thanks, please know how thankful we are at WHYY for you.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, music to look forward to in 2014, like this from U2 and producer Danger Mouse.
The sea wants to kiss the golden shore. The sunlight warms your skin.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. German Chancellor Angela Merkel reportedly made an angry phone call to President Obama when she learned that the NSA was monitoring her cell phone. She was not the only world leader to be spied on by the United States. We're checking in on three countries in Europe to gauge their view of this country as they grapple with international crises. And joining us is Holger Stark, senior Washington correspondent for Germany's Der Spiegel and co-author of WikiLeaks, Public Enemy Number One. That's the English translation of his book. And Holger Stark, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to have you, Marty. Thanks.
You're very welcome. And just how angry is Angela Merkel at the United States?
Well, Angela Merkel is a very rational figure, a very rational politician. So in these days, it's even more remarkable how calm she is and how reluctant she reacts on every attempt of the United States to milder the tone. Yesterday we had a delegation of an American senator, Christopher Murphy, visiting Berlin, but Merkel had no time for him. She wanted to at least send some signals of bringing back the German-American relationship to a better tone. But Merkel preferred to travel to Frankfurt. So she these days is really, she's very angry. She said to Obama that this is really unacceptable. Her spokesperson, Stefan Seibert, several times repeated that it's unacceptable to spy amongst friends. So Germany is in a severe uproar, and I think this is a long way to go to reestablish some trust between those two countries.
Several follow-up questions here. Is that in part because of Germany's history, whether the Stasi or even the Nazis?
Well, this is one thing that you have to consider. We had two very harsh experiences in the last century with totalitarian regimes. One was the Nazis with overall surveillance, and the second thing was clearly the Stasi experience. And Angela Merkel, for herself, is coming from East Germany, so she has some experience with that kind of totalitarian surveillance on a day-by-day basis. But secondly, you also have to see that especially the conservatives feel like this is a lost love these days. They always tried to hold down the NSA affairs during the summertime when the first reports came up that the NSA is spying on Germans. Mm. Angela Merkel said he personally got an assurance by Obama that no German law has been broken on German soil, and then it turned out that everything is wrong. Obama still in July stood up publicly and said, if I want to know something about Chancellor Merkel, I call her personally. I don't need an intelligence agency. I will call her if I want to know something about her. And now everything turns out to be wrong. And, and someone like Merkel, a person like Merkel, has a long memory. She won't forget that.
Does she want an apology?
That definitely would help, of course. But, I mean, you know how Obama is. He's not a person to apologize.
No.
So he sent a low-ranking senator like Christopher Murphy to Berlin. That's not the signal that the United States should send these days to make something better.
But are we talking about a rift between these two countries, a rift that has some serious consequences?
Well, the famous German-American historian Fritz Stern, who lectured in New York for many decades, he said this is the biggest burden for the American-German relationship since World War II, since 1945. So I would say, yes, this is a rift. We see something significant here. Especially we see a change of tone within the Conservative Party. The Conservatives traditionally in Germany have been transatlantic partners and friends with the United States for decades. They always opposed everything which came from the left, from the liberals, all kind of criticism against American hybrids, against the possible imperialism and so on. So they stick very loyal to the United States. And now these conservatives realize that they have been lied on, so that the American friends are not real friends. It turns out that at the end of the day, there is no real friendship. Obama, when he visited Berlin on June 18th, he was standing in front of the Brandenburg Gate, and he said, this is a real friendship between those two countries.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, the conservatives especially feel betrayed. The Bavarian Prime Minister, Horst Seehofer, who is a long, strong loyalist, he said this is something which will take years to repair.
There is a point of view, and I'd be curious about your response to it, which is that, of course, friends spy on each other, and that Angela Merkel and others are kind of feigning shock, you know, surprise, that the U.S. has been spying on its allies. I'd be just curious about how you respond to that point of view.
Well, this is a fair point, and I think everyone, every politician especially, knows that intelligence activities are ongoing. But look to the German-American relationship. We relied on the U.S. for decades after World War II. America was a really a long good friend for us. So for Germany, it would be impossible to spy on American soil, to spy on Americans. And there's even a clear guideline, an order from the Chancellery, that the German Foreign Intelligence Agency, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, is forbid to spy against American interests. And we're not spying on Americans. Americans are considered to be friends from a German perspective. So are a small couple of European countries. So we try, from a German perspective, to separate between, let's say, international partners, countries like China, like Russia, like many other countries internationally, and a core group of friends which are close to our interests. And this includes France, this includes Spain, Italy, and this includes, of course, also the United States of America. No one ever in Germany would spy on American interests.
I do want to talk actually about the temporary agreement over Iran and certainly the United States and Germany on the same side on this issue. But I am curious from your perspective how you see then mending this relationship between Germany and the United States.
Well, I think this will be a two-layer thing for the next future. On one hand, we will see a normalization of the relationship, of course. Both countries are too important to each other to ignore themselves for a long time. So we will see something like going back to a day-by-day business, going back to politics like usual. But on the second layer, we will have a deep mistrust, which will last there for a long time. Remember, the German government has just been re-elected. Angela Merkel will be the main partner for Obama for the next years. So will be the German Minister of Interior. So will be the Chief of the Chancellery. So we will have the main figures who are really upset right now in charge for the next years. And they are not forgetting soon. And unless the Americans are not apologizing or at least assuring what really happened, I don't see that this will go away. Remember, this is still one demand of the German government to explain what really happened. Did you monitor the cell phone of Angela Merkel? Did you monitor the German population? What really happened? And we've sent two delegations to Washington so far, and we didn't get answers. And it's pretty clear that there won't be answers anyway coming from the American government. So no one is expecting that there will come transparency. And this is a problem, because if you ask to explain what happened, if you don't get an answer, how can you rebuild trust on that basis?
And that's Holger Stark. He's senior Washington correspondent for Germany's Der Spiegel and co-author of a book, and this is the English translation, called WikiLeaks Public Enemy Number One. I do want to talk about that. And I also want to talk about this negotiation with Iran this week. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Again, checking in with three European countries and the relationship they have with the United States, how the United States is viewed in their country. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you talk about some of the tension between these two countries. But interestingly, working out an agreement over the weekend between Iran and six world powers, the U.S., Britain, France, Russia, Germany, and China. This is a temporary halt on Iran's nuclear program. Do you see that the U.S. and Germany can work together in spite of some of these differences?
Yes. For sure. This German politics are too rational, and we, of course, see how important the American states of America are for those global conflicts like the Iran conflict. For sure, this will be ongoing, but I have a look on, for example, the European-American Treaty of Free Trade, the TTIP agreement. I'm not so sure if this one is moving. This one is clearly something where we have leverage on the table, where the Europeans can put some pressure on the Americans. And don't forget, it's not only just Germany, it's also the European Union. America also spies on the EU embassies in Washington and the EU embassies in New York. So it's not only a national problem that Germany only is upset, but it's a European thing. So there are things on the table which are ongoing and others which might be stuck.
And do you think some kind of charm offensive, as we call it, or you know, an invitation to the White House? I'm trying to think about ways of smoothing out this relationship. Would that help?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I'm very much convinced. If Obama would invite Merkel and cook something nice for her and look her deep in the eyes and say, I'm really sorry, this went out of order somehow. You know how it is sometimes. Sometimes your agency are just running crazy. My dear, I'm honestly sorry. Let's make a cut here and look into the future. That would help a lot, but that didn't happen. And instead of preparing a nice dinner, he sent Susan Rice, and Susan Rice is a tough cookie. She met with Merkel's security advisor, and it was a harsh meeting as far as I heard. There was no nice tone. Hmm. So this charm offensive is still missing.
I do want to talk about the WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, but I'm also interested in whether Germans pay any attention to what goes on in the U.S. Congress, the fact that there was a government shutdown for about 2 weeks, the Affordable Care Act rollout, that's been a kind of bumpy rollout of the website. Does that register at all in Germany?
Oh, yeah, it is. It's very weird to see how this country here is, on one hand, still the most powerful country in the world, running international conflicts like Iran, like Syria and others. And on the other hand, you have a country which in many ways looks like a third world country, like a democracy which is blocked by internal conflicts, which might come to a point where this country is still not anymore operational. This is, from a German perspective, a very, very weird experience to see how this can happen.
Weird and worrisome, because if the U.S. is dysfunctional, does that hurt the country, a country like Germany?
Yes, definitely. And the worrisome thing is that if you watch it over the years, that it's getting worse. It's not that it doesn't seem like this system has the power, the energy of renew itself. It even looks like it's getting worse from all 6 months, from shutdown to shutdown, and there's no real perspective how to solve this conflict. So this is a dark perspective for the American democracy, no question.
And what does the Affordable Care Act look like to people in Germany?
Well, if it wouldn't be so sad, you could laugh about that, because in Germany everyone has a health care. So even under conservatives or with conservative circles, there is no questioning that every person should have a health care insurance. This is something that is seen very normal and very weird that there are still some ideologists here who argue that everyone should make it for himself, and there's no need for public care for people. So this is really something which is very weird from a German perspective, and also the inability to get this website run is also weird for a country. I mean, you guys invented the iPod, you invented the iPad, and 80% of the internet companies are based in America. Is it so hard to get such a website running?
You can't see me nodding my head, Holger, but and I think a lot of people listening are nodding their head as well and scratching their head, and of course hoping that the website gets up and running. Let me ask you about your book, and I can't say the German actual title. The English translation is WikiLeaks Public Enemy Number One, and because you write for Der Spiegel, and of course Der Spiegel, a very important player in this whole revelation about spying.
Well, it's interesting that WikiLeaks came together with the Snowden affair in a way, because
right.
They've sent Sarah Harrison to Moscow to accompany Edward Snowden. And on the other hand, it's also interesting to see that WikiLeaks is not really in the game, because they didn't publish anything at all from the Snowden archives. So everything from Snowden went to traditional media outlets like Spiegel or New York Times or Guardian. I think for Julian Assange, it was a good opportunity to get back in the game, at least from a rhetorical standpoint. He's in the embassy in London. I've visited him there once. He's still suffering. He would like to move. He's still afraid, even despite new reports that there's probably no sealed indictment in the United States against him. But he's still looking for his new role. And I think he was surprised to see that there's, even after the 2010 revelation of the diplomatic cables and from Bradley Manning, that there's a new whistleblower like Edward Snowden coming up and making even bigger waves than Manning did.
Do you see Edward Snowden as providing a public service to the people, to the American public, and then perhaps German public as well?
I would say so, yes. I see that, and I can't understand that the American government is treating him as a traitor or seeing him as a traitor. I think probably every government would have to do so. But if you look what kind of debate we have since June, since Snowden came up with his first revelations, that's very healthy for democracy, and it makes a difference between a democracy and totalitarian regimes. And I'm happy to see that this is possible. I'm also happy to see that it's possible to publish all those details in America, even if it hurts, even if it gets to the core of national security. Imagine what would happen in a country like China. So if you ask if Snowden did a good thing in terms of a debate in democracy, I would say yes, he did.
It's interesting to go back, and this is really when Barack Obama was running for president of the United States, and he famously went to Germany, gave a great big speech there, I think something like 200,000 people that he spoke to. Has he been kind of taken off his pedestal in the last couple of years?
Well, Obama has seen as an absolute hero, as an overwhelming, almost mystical figure in the German public. It was an irrational moment of almost loving a politician, which is rare. We don't have this relationship between the German citizens and the German public. So Angela Merkel and all German politicians always were very jealous looking on Obama. He had an approval rate of 88% still in 2010, even beside his drone campaign and all those things. But this summer, his reputation has been damaged badly. These days, last week, we had a new poll coming up. Only 43% of the Germans are still satisfied with him. So it's a cut of almost 50% coming from 88%. So I think Obama really, in the German public, faces a hard time these months, and he has to prove that he's still some of those politicians where you can put your hope in and hope and expect that things change to the better.
Well, on that note, Holger Stark, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's a senior Washington correspondent for Germany's Der Spiegel and co-author of a book. This is the English translation called WikiLeaks, Public Enemy Number One, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Again, we are checking in with three European countries, U.S. allies, and coming up next, it's France. Stay with us and give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org.
What is The Pulse? Stories at the heart of health science and innovation. WHYY-FM's newest original program launches Friday morning, December 6th at 9. The critical issues and innovations as told by patients, doctors, researchers, and everyday people. Plus, an active and growing online multimedia destination at whyy.org/thepulse. The Pulse launches Friday morning, December 6th at 9 on WHYY-FM.
On the next Fresh Air, turkey, sides, and dessert. We get some holiday cooking advice from Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop of America's Test Kitchen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Is a pathway to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants simple?
We have equality and equal opportunity in our DNA as a country. And to exclude people from that opportunity, it's a cancer.
Activists say immigration reform is good for America. Conservatives in the House say it's not so simple. That's next time on The Takeaway from Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. France's President François Hollande said America snooping on its European allies was unacceptable between friends. This was after revelations came to light about NSA data mining of phone calls of world leaders and the public. What with the Iran deal, Syria, the government shutdown in the U.S., and the political climate in Congress, one wonders how the U.S. looks to the rest of the world. Joining us now to give a French perspective is Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, Paris columnist for the Sunday Telegraph. And Anne-Elisabeth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Very nice to be on with a Philadelphia radio. I do like Philadelphia very much.
Well, we like Paris very much as well. And to our listeners, again, you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I'm curious about 5 years into the Obama presidency. What is his reputation in France today?
It is not what it was when he was elected. I was listening to my German colleague just a minute ago, and it was perfectly true in France that Obama was walking on air, and he was a symbol. And as you know, in France, we've got a strong black and African minority, and they were crying with happiness and joy. It was something very touching when he was elected, and there was a feeling that after the Bush years, America was going to heal all wounds. And now, years later, unfortunately, wounds have not been healed. New wounds have been opened up. Specific French-American divergences on politics have sort of come to mind. He doesn't even look like he's doing terribly well with his own public. So it's a great désamour, as we say here.
Yeah. And going back, I mean, I'm assuming some of the wounds that need healing go back to the U.S. relationship with France during the Bush administration. I'm assuming those are still a little bit sore.
Well, yes, but I would almost say that this is knee-jerk. George Bush, bad. And it was not really thought through, and people said things about Bush that I remember saying about Ronald Reagan before very late. People thought, well, actually Ronald Reagan may not have been such a bad president as all that. But in Bush, it was really the compendium of the Americans as the sort of irresponsible cowboys. And it's very strange, because if you remember, the day after 9/11, the headline on Le Monde, which is an institution in France, a bit like the New York Times, was, "We are all Americans." It wasn't fated to be like that, but it was like a groove that people fall back in France, in doubt, be anti-American.
Well, and the U.S. said some terrible, some people in the United States said some terrible things about the French during that time as well. We should remember that.
Well, I actually used to write for, and still do from time to time, for an excellent magazine called The Weekly Standard, which is full of those people who would joke about the cheese-eating surrender monkeys. And I will say one thing. When you actually worked with those journalists, they, now they're calling, now they're saying Vive la France, because the French foreign minister was the one who stood fast for a better deal in the West Iran negotiations recently. So all wounds can be healed in that respect.
I've been asking our guests during this hour about the NSA surveillance revelations, and I'm just curious about how that played out in France. And we were talking about Britain, and we were also talking about Germany. And any different in France, do you think?
There was an official complaint made by the French president, and there was a reaction that, you don't do this among allies. But I would say that the French were much more blasé about this, because shock horror, spies, spy. Well, we've been doing this ourselves. We know perfectly well we've been doing this ourselves. The example that always comes to mind, and in the early 90s, the first chair of economic intelligence was created in a university near Paris, Université de Marne-la-Vallée. And the professor who got the chair was the former head of the French intelligence service. And that told you in words of one syllable that we spy for our interests. So, you know, you do it to, we expect you to do it to, quite frankly.
Well, yes, indeed. Let me give that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about the relationship in this portion of Radio Times between the United States and France. You had mentioned this this deal that was ironed out over the weekend, having to do with Iran, lifting some of the sanctions on Iran, putting its nuclear development program in some kind of a temporary freeze with 6 months to kind of assess progress there. France, of course, played a very important role in this negotiations. What should we take away from France's view of Iran?
We are still very cagey about this, and the journalists who were covering the summit in Geneva came back saying, you know, there were secret direct talks between the Americans and the Iranians, and Fabius, our foreign minister, was not privy to that. So I have this secondhand, but the feeling is that that's absolutely the most we could possibly give, and we should be very wary of the danger of giving something that they absolutely want and having just a commitment to do something. So I don't know whether this is seen in America as an agreement which will sort of be reconducted almost tacitly in 6 months' time, but the French will not let this be reconducted tacitly if they feel that the Iranians are not playing the game.
Mm. And according to a story in the New York Times, that there were secret negotiations between, I think it was the New York Times, between the Obama administration and Iran for just about a year now. So there seems to be some truth to that.
Well, it is not something that the French will forget in a hurry.
But I guess for the United States, looking at this country that we have not had any kind of official relationship with, it probably means something different in this country than it does in France.
Well, we've had relations, but at the same time, we've also had Iranian terrorism in France throughout the 80s. It is perfectly true that we felt that perhaps this was not supposed to happen to us, considering that Ayatollah Khomeini, before he came back and the Shah fell, lived in France for several years. And then we had economic disagreements about actually nuclear industry, not war, you know, not peacetime, not wartime. And this was pushed with bombs in the streets of Paris. And it's something that the French have long memories and remember. And also because if you take Syria and Hezbollah, who have very often been seen as patsies of the Iranian government, in the early 80s, 58 French paratroopers were killed by a suicide bomber in Beirut. Mm. We haven't forgotten those. We haven't forgotten the French ambassador to Syria, Louis de Lamar, who was killed in Lebanon by Hezbollah. So all of this means that there's a long, difficult relationship between France and Iran as well.
And that's Anne Elizabeth Moutet, Paris columnist for the Sunday Telegraph. Again, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about the U.S. relationship with France. And again, phone calls taken at 1-888-477-9499. We talked earlier in the hour about Britain, and interestingly, France was really in support of a military intervention in Syria, unlike the British Parliament. And Elizabeth?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Sorry, I guess that was a sort of a half question there.
Yes. That is more of a first of all, there's a French historic link to Syria, because when Palestine was in British mandate, Syria was a French mandate, Syria and Lebanon. So there are lots of French-speaking people, of course, in Lebanon, but also in Syria, and there was a feeling of responsibility there. I think our president, Monsieur Hollande, also has not been so successful, but the one thing that he did right was to intervene in Mali several months ago. And he felt that perhaps this was something that he could do again. And in the end, we could not go on our own. The American Congress decided that America was not going. So that petered out. But there was certainly more will in Paris than there would have been somewhere else.
And is Olamour a hardliner? I mean, look at Mali and look at some of the interventionist, at least thinking, coming from the French president.
In terms of foreign policy and that kind of policy, yes, even though if you asked any French person in the street if our president is a hardliner, they would look at you with, open eyes, because he's not like that for anything else, and he's famed for his indecisiveness. But in foreign political decisions, he's taken some very strong and very principled decisions in the past year and a half.
And Central African Republic being one of them, yes?
Yes, and again, you've got there are very strong historical links between that part of Africa, which used to be a French colony, where there still are French interests, where the leaders come to France. There are lots of ties. Because these are countries where there are several dozen languages, and they're all completely different, the official language of the country remains French. The danger that Africa would fall like a series of pieces of dominoes and be prey to civil war is something that we take very seriously. Yeah. And our other allies in the area say you have to shore up, you have to prop up the country in question, because otherwise this will be contagious and it will come to us.
Do French people, and again, you're a stand-in for an entire country, yeah, in this portion, but do French people look at American politics? Do they listen to our Congress? Do they think about government shutdowns? Does that play in France at all?
We were a little bit aware of it, but not so much. We watch the elections. We don't necessarily understand what's going on during the elections, but the elections. And between the elections, we pay less attention, and we look at the crowd in power. And then the one thing that registered in France, and the French don't like it, they don't exactly know how it works, but it's the Tea Party. And that's something that's very, very much not the French way. Although right now, people are talking about a French Tea Party because of the anti-tax movements throughout the country. But overall, we did see the shutdown. We didn't quite realize what the shutdown entailed. It was a bit like a strike of government from the government side. Well, God knows, we know lots of things about strikes. So it was not something that we felt very surely about. It was exotic. The one thing that struck us in American politics was the huge amount of time and difficulties of Obamacare. And that is something that the French feel very strongly about, because we have a national health system. It is private and public. Unlike the British system, doctors are private individuals. And we like our system very much. And if you look at the league tables of the World Health Organization, you will see that actually we rank first, or among the absolute first. So we were thinking, well, what is this first world country that doesn't have health care for its citizens? And the French have not understood the complexities of Obamacare, and they are very surprised when they go into this that Obamacare is basically a government mandate given to a private industry. And they find this incomprehensible. So overall, they don't know so much about how it works or doesn't work, and they say, why is it not working? And the other thing is, why is this not... The one thing that the French would understand at once, because it's very much like our system, is Medicare. If you'd said Medicare for everyone, that would have been like the French system, and would have said, okay, we understand how that works.
Well, that's been a theme during this hour, talking to a representative from Britain, Germany, and now France, which is, you don't understand our healthcare system, and I think for many Americans, we don't understand it either. But, you know, France has been called, and I don't know whether this is true or you like this or not, the sick man of Europe. How does that play in France?
Oh, we love to beat our breast.
You do.
We are right now. We're in a period in which nothing ever will ever get better, and we are overtaxed. And we have too much unemployment. It is structural unemployment. We have too many regulations, and the country has come to a halt. And some of this is very true, and I've been writing about this. And some of it is, I would say, amplified by the complete pessimism that the French have had for centuries. France is a country in which You trust the state and you don't trust your neighbors. It is the opposite of the United States. The United States is a country that's based on the community. The government is far away and you don't trust it, but you trust the people who live next to you, and it's a very horizontal relationship of equals. And ours is from the kings, and it's a top-down relationship of the citizen and the state, but we trust the state to be impartial. We also trust the state to some extent to be efficient, and when it's not, or when the state over-regulates, you have this sort of feeling that nothing else can work out. And right now, we've got a great deal of unemployment. We've got extremely expensive social levies, payroll taxes, that make it extremely difficult to hire and fire people. And we've got a system that still produces good stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you will buy fly on an airplane and it will be French, or you will buy a luxury watch or a handbag and it will be French. You will drink French wine. You will drive a French car. We still make things. Too many young people want to leave the country because, quite simply, they can't find jobs. And there's a feeling that America, which has lots of failings, and frankly, we don't buy your cars in Europe, you can get up and go and find a job, and it may not be a good job, but you can change jobs. And so that's two different things.
Well, about a minute before we have to say goodbye here, but I'm just, you had mentioned strikes, and I had a brother that lived in France for a year or two, and that was one of the things that he was just amazed about, was just how it seemed like every Friday people went on strike in France. True?
Oh, that's a very specific type of strike. The Friday afternoon strike, that is yet another custom. They have it in other countries.
Start the weekend early, is that the idea?
Oh, yes. No, but we also do have strikes, and we do not have what the Germans have. But my German colleague may or may not have talked about the fact that the unions are part of the board of every large company and even mid-sized companies, and so they understand that they have a stake in the company surviving.
Well, on that note, Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's Paris columnist for the Sunday Telegraph. She's also a regular news commentator for the BBC, Al Jazeera, and France 24. The third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, again, checking in with Britain, with Germany, and with France about the relationship between those three countries and the United States. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, podcasts. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.